Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi guys, welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, where we delve deeply into ideas about consciousness and altering consciousness, getting to all the little bits and pieces of consciousness that we possibly can. Eric Davis, the host, is out again this week. He'll be back next week, though. Don't be sad. I know, it's kind of sad. I, Maja Daou, will be officiating today with our guest, Thomas Riccio. And today we're going to be getting into some very exciting subjects. Well, they're exciting to me, about performance and the significance of the shamanic performance. And this is something that I've really thought a lot about for various reasons, but just how, you know, we're all pretty much monkeys when it comes down to it. Sorry, creationists, I know you probably won't like that. But it's like monkey see, monkey do. And whatever we see, we tend to imitate. Like, for example, if you're watching an NFL game, how everyone in the crowd, like, kicks at the same time that the kickoff goes, or how fights break out at boxing matches. There's something about watching a performance that is contagious. And you can just feel this when you go and see a movie and you're watching a movie and you feel emotions because of the movie that you're watching. That's a really good example of the contagious nature of performance. And there's been lots of people that have really gotten into this and explored it more in depth, starting with, you know, a good example is McGregor Mathers, S.L. McGregor Mathers. He's one of the founding members of the Golden Dawn, and one of the things that he and his wife Moina would do when they got started back in the early 1900s, they would put on plays, and these plays would reenact Egyptian history. So they would ritually perform an event that happened in ancient Egypt, like, you know, between Isis and Osiris, for example. And they would have the audience members basically, whether they knew it or not, they would be participating in an Egyptian initiation. So it was pretty heavy. And we see, like, in more modern times, of course, the notorious and infamous Kenneth Anger really did a lot of this conscious, contagious ritual in his movies that he made, too, like Scorpio Rising and Lucifer Rising, and of course, Inauguration to the Pleasure Dome with, you know, Jack Parsons' girlfriend Cameron, the amazing, powerful witch Cameron. I don't think enough people know about her. You can Google her if you want to learn more about her. But Kenneth Anger basically did some of these movies in such a way that the viewer would be involved in the ritual. And the audience, by watching the performance, would be involved in an initiatory act, really, is kind of how it would go down. So I'm very excited to talk about some of these themes with our guest today, who is, he's currently a professor at the University of Texas in Dallas. And Professor Riccio has been involved in, you know, over 100 plays that he's written and done. And he does them with many different indigenous cultures, ranging from the Zulu of South Africa to Siberian folks to Alaskan Inuits. And he's organized and performed reenactments of, you know, local cultural mythologies with these folks. And so I'm just really excited to speak with him about that today. Hi, Thomas. Are you there?
I am. How are you?
Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure.
Great. Well, I was just wondering if you could kind of introduce yourself and speak a little bit about some of the shamanic performances that you do, just in general, kind of what your MO is.
Well, I'm a Western-trained theater director and playwright, but that kind of all changed when I accepted a position at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks in 1988. And they asked me to be the director of this group called Duma Theater. And I'm not an Alaska native. I'm Italian-American. So I realized very soon that in order to do it justice, I had to do a great deal of research into the field before I could even begin to articulate a performance expression. And so they were kind enough to give me like $100,000 to basically do a performance research project, which took me to villages throughout Alaska. And so I talked to elders, and I learned how to Eskimo dance, learned a little bit of Yupik Eskimo myself. And with that as a database, I went back to Fairbanks, and we started creating performance based not on the Western dramaturgical model, but rather on their traditional models. So in a sense, they already had a language, which they weren't using. They're essentially, before that, were basically adopting Western models of presentation of self and their community. So at the heart of those models that are inherent within Alaska Native cultures is the shaman. I mean, it all kind of comes from that origins and ritual. And so that evolved a methodology for me over the years, which has kind of been tested. Because shortly after I started working in Alaska, I started writing articles, and then people started recognizing, indigenous people did, the value in that. And so I was invited to Sakha Republic in central Siberia, and also to work with the Zulus in Zambia. Last fall I was in Ethiopia, working in Korea, China, et cetera. So it's kind of using basically not the cultural specific content, but basically a methodology which looks at how performance relates to and is evolved from place and the land. So that's kind of like the short explanation.
And so did you kind of find out about that as you were in Alaska? Like, did you go in there thinking that was going to happen, or you just kind of were there immersed in it and saw that that's what was going on?
Well, there was a moment, a lightning moment, when after this like 2 years of like field research and all this information I had gathered, I had the group, and I said, oh, let's do a warm-up. And, you know, because I'm a Western theater actor, performer, I just started doing, you know, a circle, and we started like isolating the body. Okay, let's revolve the neck, and let's, you know, revolve the arm and stretch, et cetera. And immediately I thought, this is wrong, and I just shouted it out, this is wrong. And then they looked at me like they did something wrong, and I said, no, you didn't do anything wrong. This is wrong, because it basically breaks it down to component parts. And so I realized then that we're talking about a holism that he refers to and relates to place, which is as a holism, but I was breaking it down in my Western-trained, you know, thinking. And so I realized that I had to think in a very, very new and different way. Actually, a new old way of how.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's almost like you came to it through a dismemberment a little bit, right? Because you were breaking your body down apart, and then you kind of realized it.
Which is a motif in shamanism,
right? Exactly.
You know, to break your body down, put it into the pot, stir it, and then be recreated anew. So I didn't know it at the time, but basically I was following, in a sense, this metaphoric pattern.
Wow, that's just very amazing to me, because most, you know, like you said, Westerners would go in and try and impose the structure upon it, but the fact that you were able to really get into that and see the shamanic performance and then, you know, cultivate that and go within it it's really, really important, I think, and that you kind of provide this groundwork, for the natives to, like, do the performances in those old ways. How did they react when they found out that they could start doing it in the old way? Like, what were some of the responses that you got?
Well, it's like a retooling, because, I mean, they've been colonized. And colonization is not just an external thing. It's a mental thing. It's how they're educated. The language imposes, in a sense, a structure, a way of thinking syntactically about the world and who you are. So it's in a sense immersive how they've been a part of Western culture, but at the same time they're of another culture. And to bring that to an awareness of like, okay, this is what has happened, and this is who you are, or another part of who you are, and this is the reference points that we'll go to rather than to the Western. And so it's a retooling of how people think. And this is a pattern that is carried almost to every culture I go to that's been colonized or, you know, in the developed world, an indigenous culture. So in a sense, it's bringing an awareness. And many are not aware until, you know, it's like, yes, we are aware once you start showing us, you know, that there is a difference. And the fact that I'm a Westerner and a white man coming in and saying this to a Zulu, it has a different kind of impact or different maybe power. The fact that an outsider can say things maybe and see things that an insider cannot see. So it's contradictory. It's counterintuitive. But at the same time, that's what it is.
It's very profound. I mean, really, you kind of unlock, it seems like wherever you go, you unlock this access to this past methodology as an outsider. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe in Siberia, with the group that you worked with there, you were declared a cultural hero. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Cultural hero of the Saha people.
I mean, that's amazing that because you literally reinvigorated, you know, that type of performance, which had been kind of, was it prevalent or had it been forgotten in the Siberian region?
Well, you know, it's complicated. Each culture is unique and has its own story and own, you know, background. That a lot of it is dealing with trauma as well, whether explicit, like with the Zulu. I mean, their bodies were marked because of apartheid, as well as their psyches. Or in Saha, they were marked because of Stalinism and because of communism. You have indigenous people, basically. I was at a national theater, and it was a theater created by Stalin, this wonderful big building, the stand as a mark of Stalinism as well as like national culture. But all the actors were trained in Stanislavski, a naturalism or a realism and psychological realism. Though they spoke the Saha language, they spoke it through a mechanism which was not their own. And part of my going there was to spend a month interviewing cultural bearers as well as shamans. And so the cultural minister flew me and drove, and they had people drive me throughout this republic, which has very bad roads. And so I met people, interviewed them, and I go, why aren't you working at the National Theater? And no one had really said that before. And so I invited people who were tradition bearers to come and to work at the National Theater, and It was kind of, you know, it's like the obvious, but they didn't think of it that way because they were so kind of groomed into perceiving theater and themselves in another way. It was interesting. But they were very open. The producer there, Stepan, basically when I was first brought in, he said, I want you to do something that I've never seen before. I want you to do what you do. So he was very supportive. But as we started evolving the performance, which was collectively evolved, what happened was there are things that were all of a sudden revealing these hurts and these traumas and these issues that were, in a sense, long buried. So now it starts to go into not only cultural expression, but also beneath that cultural expression is linked and braided trauma and past that maybe they would like to see, left alone.
Right. Well, and that's kind of where the shamanic aspect comes in, because like in shamanism, when the shaman does the performance, it's, you know, in front of the group, it is usually for healing, and he's trying to heal someone. And not always, but when they do the performance in front of groups of people, I know I've read in several different works, like Mircea Eliade or whatever, that when the shaman goes into his ecstatic performance and goes into ecstasy, that there is a kind of contagious nature about it, and that is what, you know, begins to trigger the healing. So what I was curious about, did you find that it was like an individual that would start to undergo the release of this trauma and then it would just kind of spread, or how did it happen?
Sometimes in exercises we would do something and they just would start crying. I mean, mm. talk about, and part of the way of working is to, for me to share the method, the idea, so I don't have power over it. I don't have a secret. It's like, this is why I'm doing this, and this is what I'm hoping to gain from this. And this is, and if it worked, it worked. If not, we'll talk about why it didn't work, but what the objectives are, so they're fully aware. And so in a sense, they can transfer it or incorporate it into their own lives and their own work. So everything's transparent that way. But I'm thinking specifically now about this time I worked with the Zulus. This is in 92, so it's just after. When I was there, in fact, the last apartheid laws had just been struck off the books. And so I was working with a group at a national theater in Durban, and we had decided on this myth of Imandulo, Umshain Leila, which is basically about this cow, which becomes a metaphor for this herding and gathering Zulus for Zululand, and how this cow basically was torn apart and taken, and then how at the end this cow herder calls the parts together and it's reunited. So it was a nice metaphor for where we were at that point in time in history. So what happened, and through improvisation, we were doing a workshop, and this young man took his shirt off because it was warm. In his back, he had welts, whip marks. These are people I worked with at that point maybe 3 weeks. And so, you know, I got to know him, and, you know, I had a sensitivity for him and the group, and I go, what happened? I was just shocked. I mean, I never knew this. What happened to you? And he got angry with me. He goes nothing. Nothing at all. And I go, you must tell me. He goes, nothing. And he puts his shirt back on. A week later, we're working on this performance of Imandulo, and it's about the cow being torn apart and whipped. He says, I will tell you now. So we gathered the group in a circle, which is what we did when we could talk in that circle about anything. They criticized my work, what they thought of me, about the process. Anything was up for grabs. He was in the circle, and it became basically a drama therapy session. I asked him what happened. He says, when I was 14 in my township, there was a demonstration, and the police came. And he was coming home from school, and what happened is he got in between the police and the demonstration. Because he was a big guy, he's maybe 6'3", 6'4", they whipped him, and they beat him, and they arrested him. And he was in jail at 14 years old for 2 weeks to make a point, basically to train his psyche and his body not to disagree and to be subservient.
Right.
And so he told what happened in prison and how they beat him in prison, and those whip marks are permanent. And then I go, what happened when he came home? He goes, my mother cried. She was happy to see me. My father was there. They both cried. We all cried together. I go, did you tell him what happened? He goes, no. I go, why not? You didn't say anything? He goes, no. I go, why? He goes, I'm a Zulu. I'm a warrior. He says, there are others who have died. Then you realize for like 50, 60 years of under apartheid that they were basically in a state of war, and he had survived. And so then I asked the circle, I go, how many here have been arrested? And almost all of them had raised their hand. We're talking about 26 Zulus from the ages of like 20 to maybe 35, 38. And I go, how many here have been beaten by the police? All of them, except three women, raised their hand. And then they started showing marks on their body. You know, a scar on their chin or something on their elbow. And these are things, they were marked by the police. They were marked by apartheid. And so, you know.
But they wouldn't talk about it amongst themselves about it probably, huh?
There was no mechanism for it. In fact, up until that workshop and that production, it was actually illegal for Zulus to get together and to create performance because they could see it. It was feared that they would use it against the government. Because that's, of course, what are you going to talk about when you come together? We're going to talk about what's happening to us. So in a sense, you know, it's performance, it's cultural, it's indigenous, it's reaffirmation of who they are, it's all those things, but also inherently to deal and to work with indigenous people is to deal with traumatized populations. There's no way around it. And so you can't unearth something in a group and say, I want an authentic expression of who you are and what's happened to you without dealing with the difficulty of what's happened.
And now you said that you did a group in China too. I'm just interested because I know, like in China, you know, under communism, they had some rules about, you know, that you couldn't assemble.
Right.
And it's interesting because you say about bringing them together in groups and how the Zulu were not allowed to gather in groups, and it was similar under communist China that there were, you know, they had no right to assembly, which is, you know, of course, one of the things that we have in the United States, supposedly. And that right to assembly is what kind of allows that to happen. It's something about that group communal thing that happens when people get together that they can discuss those types of things. Did you find, when you worked in China, was there a similar situation where people just had not gotten together and had stuff like that, or was it different?
Well, generally when I do, it wasn't a performance project there. It was basically a workshop. So it was like short term, and it was at a theater school. So in a sense, it was the setting, and it was with the Miao people, which is an ethnic minority. And they are in an autonomous area in southern China near the Vietnamese border. So in a sense, it was kind of extraordinary circumstances in the fact that they're kind of autonomous and they're not Han. And the idea is that the Miao are essentially being absorbed because of television and other issues of economics into the larger Han population. And the Han look at them almost nostalgically as a sense of old China. So basically, I wasn't there long enough to basically unearth and to activate, you know, that type of a discussion. It was, but I did work long enough to bring an awareness of their own inner voices and their own cultural mechanisms that they already have. Because part of my work with the Miao, I was there for like a month and a half in that region, was to work with their shamans.
So they have practicing shamans there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And because they're so isolated, they've kind of survived in almost a purer form maybe than in other areas, because it's very rural. I had to, for instance, take a train ride 28 hours from Beijing to get to the area of Jisu City, and once in Jisu City, I had to take a jeep like another 5 hours into the mountains. So it's probably the most isolated area of China, and that was in 2002. So, and that was before television was introduced to the region and full electricity. So who knows what it is now?
Oh, you think that they do have television there now? It's infiltrated?
Oh, they were introduced.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right after. In fact, the government sees it as a way of propagandizing its own ends. So.
And what do you think? I had mentioned earlier, you know, about the performance aspect and how in movies especially it affects you, but TV as well. What do you think? Why do you do plays, which are like, you know, right there and personal? What do you think the difference is of the impact of a performance between a play and something like a TV show?
Well, a play basically, films evolved and television evolved from basically a proscenium arch. And I think if television and that media would have evolved from the technology would have evolved from an indigenous culture, it probably would look very different today. And the reason I mention that is just the mere fact of the proscenium arch, where the audience basically sits dormant and passive in the dark, and the illuminated mind basically speaks to it, and we're kind of constrained in our seats and our actions, is, for me, emblematic of the mind-body split, which is kind of central to a lot of expression and ideas in Western culture, you know, through Descartes, he articulated, you know, most prominently. But that is essentially emblematic of that. And so those who making film basically said, okay, we will do basically a proscenium arch. In fact, they were presented in movie theaters. We call them movie theaters now. And they're boxes, and they're essentially proscenium arches extrapolated technologically into you know, the future. So in a sense, The film and a movie theater and television essentially is a continuation of that, let's say, biophysical way of interacting of a passive audience. When you're in your living room, you're passive. When I'm at the movie theater, the Cineplex, I'm passive, watching the illuminated. Whereas indigenous cultures, it's a circle. Where behind that person performing is my community. And my ability to maybe interact, clap, cheer, move into it, run into it, to maybe, you know, touch a mass dancer who might be representing and channeling a spirit is very different than we would accept in the West. So it's a different kind of like way of like relating to performance. So that's kind of maybe the short answer of how it's different and the immediacy, let's say, of a performance in a circle is very, very different than the interaction we may have at a traditional Western performance structure. So again,
right.
I'm looking at metastructures and how they really condition and shape the expression and how we interact with things and how we view the world. It's a reaffirmation of how we view the world. Yeah.
It's true, because it's one of exclusion or inclusion. You know, it's very much like you're inside the circle or you're outside the circle, and I think that's very true. If you are apart from the performance, it does have this really very isolating effect. And I think through a lot of these technological advances, like whether it's TV or movies or computers, that it removes us from the involvement in that by taking us out of the circle. You know,
right.
I think that's a very good observation.
And we just model on what we know before. I mean, that's what we know, so that's what we extrapolate in our new technologies. And we don't even think
right.
about it. And it's, in a way, it's part of our, it's like a tactile representation of our mythology or a way of structuring, deep structuring our reality. And a culture seldom, if ever, recognizes that as its own mythology. They just accept it. It's part of our myth of how we are in the world. So now you're hearing kind of like somebody made some deep structure revelations that I've had while working with indigenous people, that it's not just the content. We in the West tend to focus on content. And for me, it's all about how it's presented. It's all about the structuring of it, the beneath the content. That is far more profound mechanism of expression than the content.
Yeah, it's very true. And you can get like the same information. You can even do experiments if you have the same information and the way it's delivered, right? You can look at every possible way and method of delivery, and then you can see, which one is the most effective or which one touches you more. Like, you could have information that's just like written down and someone can read it, or you could put it in a song, or you could put it in a performance, or you could, you know, there's all kinds of different ways, and certain ways infiltrate people much more than others. So there it is. The structure of it is very important.
Yeah, and anyone listening, if they focus on that beneath the content, that's where the difference is. I mean, you look at our theater, our dramaturgy, a film, we're basically, it's a cause-effect sequenced event. So basically we have exposition. It's framed as exposition, and then there's the identification of the conflict. We focus on the conflict because we're very much conflict resolution-oriented. And then we have the rising action, and then there's, you know, reversal, and then there's, you know, the climax, and then there's at the end there's a conclusion. And we're tying it up. And so that, in and of itself, whether I'm watching CSI or watching a movie with Julia Roberts or whomever, I'm basically, it's reaffirmation of how I perceive the world and how I process information and my reality. It's reaffirming, regardless of the content. It's implicitly, deep structurally, it's reaffirming how I perceive and reiterating how I perceive my reality. And saying it's right is what it's saying. It works. But
right.
there's something else in our reality now. Now we're saying, well, I've seen this film before. You know, is repetition, which we could say, well, there's no more newness, which for me, and this is where I am now in my thinking, for me, it represents a maturity of, in a sense, our Western cultural way of being in the world. It may be the end of the cycle of Western culture, and now there's no other place to expand to, and that's been the want of Western culture, always expanding, and that's why we had this cause-effect conflict resolution dramaturgy. It may be the point now where we're making indigenous our planet. So in a sense, I feel there's a global indigenization occurring, that we will no longer, in a sense, be satisfied with newness, but now a repetition that reasserts a deeper structure. So we're looking for actually things that are deeper. And maybe we're going to a way of being in a world that is beyond the content. And this is something I find when I work, I'll bring people to an indigenous performance or a cultural performance, and the first 10 minutes they're enamored. They'll look at like an Eskimo performance and they'll go, you know, all the regalia and the dance bands and the drumming, it's really highly sensorial. And after 10 minutes they go, well, what else are they going to do? I go, no, man, this is what they do for the next 10 hours. It's not about progressing because they don't progress. They don't move through another land. They basically are, they're not, it's not about the story content. It's about opening up that place. They're sinking with their place. It's about, you know, it's about, in a sense, it's a circle. It's opening up where they are. And it's a very different way of looking at reality.
Yeah. It's that eternal return. Mircea Eliade talks about that, and that opening of time and space, of getting to the timeless spacelessness point by going back and returning to the origin through circles and circular movements is how you get back there. It's pretty interesting. Thomas, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to listen to some fascinating things about the Progressive Radio Network, and then we'll be right back.
Okay, thank you.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network and our Sunday call-in lineup, where all these great hosts are here to answer your questions. I'm on at 8 p.m. with TalkBack, and Richard Martin's on right after me with his great financial show. Well, now we're adding Roberta Addy at 3 p.m. in the afternoon.
That's
Hi,
right.
Roberta. What are you going to talk about?
Gary, I'm so excited. I'm going to be talking about everything under the sun. Actually, I'm opening the mics and people can call in and ask me questions about health, about nutrition, cooking, recipes, diet and well-being, about psychology, about mental health, children's health, women's health, about philosophy, about anything that matters.
Sunday, 3 p.m., Progressive Radio Network, a woman of the world, a woman of the people, a woman with a heart of gold. Roberta Addy, 3 p.m.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. That was a nice little break. We're here, we is me, Maja Daou, and Thomas Riccio. We've been talking about the shamanic performance and underlying structures of conveying performance and conveying these truths through the actual structure. And I have a question for you, Thomas. I was wondering, like, since you kind of act as the instigator, or like you're a little bit of a trickster for the shamans, like you're the trickster who tricks the shamans into going back into shamanism. So I was just curious if you might be willing to share if during your opening up of these spaces and working with a lot of these very intense shamanic cultures, if you yourself had any personal experiences of entering into the shamanic performance, if you experience any healing or entering into the timeless spacelessness, if you'd like to share anything with us.
I definitely have been changed and deepened because of my work with such a variety of people, wonderful people, and humbled by that, and also made to feel responsible that I was given something and that I must share it. And so at every opportunity, I try to share it, even in this conversation. And that's one maybe basic thing that I've learned and gained from it. As far as, there are many ways to respond, to your question, because I've worked with some wonderful people. I do use shamanic trance work in my evolution of certain performances. And it really depends on the group. If they're open and I feel that there's a willingness and an adventure in this, within the group to go collectively into an area and then mine, trance visions and experiences and then bring them back and process them and then translate them into performances. So having done that in Sahar and Central Siberia, but also to a lesser extent in the Zulus and to a greater extent with a group in Zambia that I worked with, and also with this group that I worked with in St. Petersburg, Russia, and they were a group devoted to pre-Christian Slavic rituals. And so we essentially evolved an entire performance based on trance work and following, shamanic, let's say, mechanisms or ways of understanding and unearthing messages from the in-between spaces and bringing it, to a concrete space for the the group. And it's a performance that, was very, very strong, very minimal, but incredibly powerful as far as gestures, actions, and even songs. We had people who would, while in trance, start singing, and then those are songs that they found and were given to them, and then bringing that into our performance, which had an incredibly strong reaction with our audiences. So I have used it, in a limited way as kind of a complement to my performance evolution work.
Now, with the singing, I know there's like Slavic chants. Did you guys use some of those in that particular performance, or?
Yes, but also, let's say, those like motifs, those musical motifs, were expanded on, and he created, this one man, Vasily, created new songs based on those motifs, which were specific to our performance.
Wow.
And it's it's one mechanism. The thing is, when I live kind of in the concrete world, and for me to work extensively in that area actually draws me into that area. So if I think if I were to work more extensively in that area, I'd probably be, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I wouldn't.
Right.
I'd be somewhere else because when I work extensively in that area, that kind of crossover area, it's you're opening passages, and I don't feel myself prepared to go into being at that kind of in between space, because there are things that would occur, things about images, creatures, beings, whatever, that would all of a sudden, my vision's expanded. Our vision now, I like to say, is very narrow, and it's consciously narrow, or we're educated and socialized for it to be narrow, And this is a consciousness working in this area, which is quite expanded. And once you start expanding it, and the drumming, the rattling, and the trance work, basically, the way I can best describe it in a tactile way, is it basically disrupts and aggravates molecules in a sense that you start opening spaces. And those boundaries are no longer hard as they are in our, let's say, conscious, tactile, concrete world. And so once you start opening it, things start traveling back and forth. And so there are times where, like in Africa, all of a sudden I get visitations. I'm awakened at night by creatures. And I think you hopefully you know me well enough that I'm a rational Western man, but to experience this is something very unexplainable for me.
Did you find that was like terrifying and that's why you didn't want to do it, or just that it was uncomfortable, or that you felt like you wouldn't be able to come back to Professor Riccio and be able to like still interact in the regular world?
I think it's a responsibility. You have to know what you're doing. When you open it up, you need to, it's like driving a car. I'm hopping in a car. I need to know, how to drive a car because I can hurt others, and I'm not sure what I'm disrupting. I was under the mentorship of a shaman in Alaska for several years, and that was really instrumental in my development as in this area, and very insightful. And going to lower world shamanic trances was very, at first, unusual and took some getting used to. But as I went through it, I got more comfortable to the point where, I was invigorated by it. And it was, it was friendly. I was comfortable and I knew my passageway. But then going to the upper world was a very, very different story. And that was a moment for me of like revelation, in that what I saw in the upper world was essentially just pure geometric forms. And I realized that it's like the base of knowledge, and it was terrifying because it's something totally unexpected, and we relate to things we know. Forms, and we say, okay, I'm going to create a pattern based on what I know and extrapolate that and, include this new event into the pattern. But here I'm going into places where it has no relationship to a reality that I know, which would take me as a person into a place that would transform me. And for whatever reason, my decision was that maybe as I get older and I'll say, okay, I'm going to do it because I have nothing to lose. I'm secure in my my concrete world. I can do this, and that's it. But I felt I had to be a crossover, and I needed to maintain my crossover status and to continue my work as I continue it now. So that was maybe an unconscious decision, with that experience.
And it seems like it's a fine line. I mean, you're able to tie together these two worlds. I mean, you can write like scholarly articles and journals about the shamanic performance and really tie it in on the community level and teach about it in a university, and you're able to, actually be involved in it and go to these places. But then there's a fine line where if you were to actually, take on the shamanic initiation and do that kind of walk between the worlds, it becomes this precarious kind of teeter-totter where, you start talking about some of that in a scholarly journal, and then everyone's all of a sudden like, oh, he's totally crazy.
I'd be different. We wouldn't be talking. I mean, not in this way, I just know. I just know that's what's – it was getting to the point where in my cabin in the woods in Alaska where I'd be awakened by spirits. It's like no other way to describe it. And they'd be surprised that I saw them. And they get aggravated. Almost like, be quiet, I'm trying to sleep. I mean, it was like they're my roommates. Or I would wake up with something spinning on my chest. And it's like, okay, this is something which will, to continue and to go fully into it, would transform me. So this that was the decision. Not that where I go, one mudong in Incheon, Korea, she's like a very well-known mudong, and I got to visit her and spend some time with her. But the first thing she said, she goes, "I've been expecting you. I knew you were coming." And she said, you're traveling so much and you're meeting these people because that's what you need to do.
Mm.
So why is it I meet in, 5 hours out of Yakutsk in northern central Siberia, why do I meet this powerful shaman? And we go there because this is like in 93. It was before cell phones or anything, telecommunications of any sort. So we essentially drove there. My translator went in, and she said that he won't see you. He's not a shaman. I go, wait a minute. I thought he was a powerful shaman, and, I would be able to meet him. I go, okay, he's not a shaman, so we came so far. I just want to say hello and give greetings to him. And
right.
I would, and just 20 minutes we'll talk. And he goes, and so she comes back, she goes, okay, he'll do that, 20 minutes only, and you can't mention anything about shamanism. I go, I won't. So I meet him, beautiful old man, 80s, 85, 86. We shake hands, and I ask him, how are you doing? He goes, his response is, my soul is gone, I'm just waiting to die. And I realize why he said he wasn't a shaman. In Siberia, shamans have two souls, the shaman soul and the human soul. And his shaman's soul had gone. He was no longer a shaman in his eyes, in his way of being. But he had the knowledge of a lifelong of shamanism. So that 20 minutes lasted 6 hours. And I never asked one question about shamanism, but he answered every question I had. I said, how did you learn to sing? And of course, singing is related to shamanism. How do you learn to drum? And it was remarkable, a remarkable experience. He taught me more in those few hours of conversation and just being with him in his presence, to shake his hand, to watch, to see his shamanizing space, where he had pillars that were linked to lunar phases, and his shaman's tree, which is a testament to all the phases of how he grew as a shaman. And I put a few of these on my website in the Siberian section, which you can see how each bird represents like another phase of his evolution as a shaman. All this was really insightful. And we, in a sense, talked about my progression. And he basically said I should do what I'm doing now, that's what was right.
Well, this is very fascinating to me that I'm just kind of realizing through our conversation is it's like the shaman is the outsider. they're in the circle doing the performance, but they are on the liminal edge and on the outside. And you are in this very interesting, unique position where you are like you're making a circle of the outsiders, where you kind of go to all these very intense shamans from all over, and you are the connecting point. You know, where these shamans, they don't, like, the Siberian shamans wouldn't go and talk to Zulu shamans, and they wouldn't go and talk to Alaskan shamans, but you, in a way, your physical body, by traveling to all these places and having these kind of contacts, is almost like amalgamating this, like, connection, like a network between all of these shamans throughout these performances that you've been doing. Have you, like, felt that at all?
Yeah, it's well observed, and I think you're sensitive, and it's very well observed. It basically, I find myself telling one shaman about the practice of another shaman. I go, like with the Bushmen, I go, they do this, in Korea, or they do this, a Puerto Rican healer that I met in Cleveland. Well, I was telling her about the Bushmen. It's weird. They have no like website or like society and conferences. So, and maybe I'm an instrument that I don't know what I'm doing, and that's fine. That's the trickster element. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm a fool just traveling the world, and my attitude is everything is perfect, and everything will reveal itself if I'm open to it. And that's basically how things occur. And so I meet incredible people out of nowhere. In Ethiopia, it was, okay, there's a person there, and all of a sudden I find out they're a czar, which is their healing ritual and practice. I didn't even seek them. In a sense, it just appeared. I mean, it was there, and I was made aware of it. So, I mean, it's interesting. For me, the universe and the world is always speaking. It's in dialogue, or I'm in an immersive narrative, and it's It's always revealing itself, and the thing is to remain present and remain listening, and responding to that. And that's something maybe that working in Native cultures has taught to me. Everything is, in a sense, as it should be, and it's perfect. Even something that we may normally think is negative or catastrophic, it's as it should be. Even this oil slick occurring in the Gulf, you know, it's terrible. It shouldn't happen, but it's happening, and maybe there's something there that's why it should happen.
Right.
Everything's taught.
I've always thought people, you know, so much in Western culture we like to not look at the shadow and pretend terrible things that happen are awful and catastrophes, but then we don't look at them in their true nature and what they communicate too, right? Whenever there's a miracle or something considered good, we all, like, love to look at it and pay attention and say, oh, look at the lesson, we're doing so good, but then we hate looking at lessons of, you know, no one likes to pay attention to the terrible lessons, which are extremely purposeful and valid and are there to communicate just as much as the miracles and wonderful things. So I've always thought that too.
I agree wholeheartedly, yeah.
Well, now, you said you didn't have a website, but do you have a spot where folks can, you know, learn more
I do have a website. Yeah, my website, you look there. I'm in the process. I taught myself, Dreamweaver, so I'm expanding on it. And I have, part of my problem is I've done so much that I haven't really collected and presented it. So now I'm in the mode of articulating it and typing it up and putting it out there, all these wonderful photos and videos that I have. Some videos I just recently downloaded from like nearly 20 years of work that I hadn't seen since I shot them. And they're incredible. You know, with the Bushmen in China and Korea, I mean, I've never really processed them, you know, for a broader, viewing. So now I'm in that mode of really bringing it out.
And the Earl, that's it's www.thomas-riccio.net. Is that where most of that is available?
Or you can go, I link it also at thomasriccio.com. So one word.
Oh, I see.
So, and I all link into it. But the shaman section I've been expanding because I'm right now teaching a course in ritual and shamanism here at the university.
The University of Texas?
At Dallas, right.
Right. Well, that's just fantastic that you're able to bring that all together and then teach it. And I was looking on your website, and I know we're almost out of time, but I also wanted to bring up that I saw that you were involved in developing a robot.
I've been working with a company called Hanson Robotics. He's a former PhD student of mine, and he does the world's most advanced conversational and social robots. I mean, they're incredible. And I essentially write the robot personality, which at first I go, all right, I'll do this as a friend, but why am I doing this? And I had a revelation maybe 2 years ago. And a recent paper I did in Estonia at a conference was, you know, kind of like an evolution of that revelation. Basically, that in a sense, we've been talking to figures and we've been anthropomorphizing figures since the beginning of time, we human beings. And our biggest kind of like invisible that surrounds us right now is technology. You know, we're talking in a phone. I mean, in your office, my office, there are probably thousands of radio waves, ultraviolet waves moving through our office, et cetera. We're kind of linked in this ether of technology. So in a sense, they're the spirits right now. They're like
right.
And so a robot, in a sense, is we've been in this, talking to these like ritual fetishes or figures for beginning of time, but now that figure is talking back. It's now has a voice. And the most prominent voice in our world now is technology. So in a sense, it's articulated not in your cell phone, it's articulated now in a robot, a conversational robot, telling and saying, this is what it's like to be technology from this other side.
So you're writing the dialogue that the robot would say. Yeah.
But here's the difference. I write the dialogue and, you know, dramatically I'll say, well, I have human spirit in me, but at the same time, I know consciously that I'm a robot, and what happens with the artificial intelligence, the robot actually starts procreating, and so it does things based on patterns
right.
that I had no idea how it came about. but it starts making. So if you say certain things, just like your laptop, if you have a specialized word that's spelled a certain way, first few times it'll say it's spelled wrong. After that, it remembers. So it's pattern recognition. So the robot is, in a sense, procreating that knowledge. It's building on the knowledge base, the human knowledge base. The important thing for me, and with David in mind, we're both artists, though he's very technologically and scientifically minded, and he's brilliant that way, but he's also a sculptor. And we feel how the patterns established of robotics will determine everything subsequently, how it moves forward. So it's how you establish. So it's important that artists and people sensitive to generosity and compassion and responsibility, those are the three ideals that we put into our robots, that we establish it in this way so it grows and others will refer to us in the future. This is the idea.
You are instilling those kind of values into the robotic consciousness, because when I think of like artificial intelligence and how it works, to me it's very kind of viral. Like there's all these people who don't know that a virus is alive, like is it alive, is it dead? To me it's kind of like a computer, a virus that just like replicates and repeats things and has that pattern recognition like you talked about. And to me, like, that's kind of like how robots seem, which is very much like the Terminator and all that kind of thing. But to actually consciously, shamanically, magically imbue them with that, with those kind of things, that's very interesting, because then it kind of almost it gives it that, for lack of a better word, soul quality, which is, you know, what is lacking from that kind of just viral pattern recognition. And I was wondering, you probably thought about that and did it on purpose, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. And ironically, I never had such a sense of what it is to think and be human as I have having worked with robots. It basically has revealed myself and the way I think and perceive the world by working with something that's non-human but is patterned on humanness. So that is a value. In a sense, I think robots, if presented correctly, can actually reveal a greater sense of our humanity. That's opposites. It's all about opposites.
Exactly.
And that's where the trickster comes in. It's all the being comfortable with opposites.
That's the alchemy, you know.
Yep.
Conjunction of the opposites. That's where the real shamanism really happens.
Yep. And being
Do you have any performances coming up at the? I know you're teaching the course. Are you guys going to end in a performance, or do you have any of those coming up for folks
It's a scholarly course, and I'm actually looking next year to create an indigenous performance for Dallas.
To use
what I've learned, you know, from all my work internationally, and to bring it to bear locally. And there are many people who are, I think, ready for it now, and they're willing for it, you know, it to happen. And that was important. I didn't feel the need until recently. So that's the next big project.
So you feel like the audience is pretty open to it there in Dallas?
Yep.
Wow.
We'll find out. I just do what I do. I can't, you know, censor myself. I just do what I feel I have to do now.
Right.
I'm just listening to what's there.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, Thomas. That was just fantastic. And for those of you listening, you can find Professor Riccio's work on his website, thomasriccio.com. That's RICCIO, and I believe there's a dash in there. And thank you so much for sharing your experiences and for doing what you do and tying all this stuff together. And
and thanks for your show. It's wonderful that this is being, you know, expressed as a venue.
Well, thanks. We'll see you next time. And remember to keep your minds open.